This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Welcome to the TriDot Podcast. We are working our way through a three-week series where we aim to solve your 10 biggest swim problems, your 10 biggest bike problems, and your 10 biggest run problems. And today is the day we will talk about running. Our first coach joining us for this conversation is TriDot Master Coach Jeff Rains. Jeff is a certified TriDot coach, a USA Triathlon Level 2 coach, an Ironman U certified coach, and he has a Master of Science in Exercise Physiology and was a D1 collegiate runner. He has over 60 Ironman event finishes to his credit, including the World Championships in Nice, France. Plus, he has coached hundreds of athletes to the Ironman finish line. Jeff has been training and coaching with TriDot since 2015. Jeff Rains, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Andrew. I'm ready to hit the ground running today on this run episode.
Yeah, you are. Also with us is professional triathlete and TriDot coach Elizabeth James. Elizabeth is a USA Triathlon Level 2 and Ironman U certified coach who quickly rose through the triathlon ranks using TriDot, from a beginner to top age grouper to a professional triathlete. She's a Kona and Boston Marathon qualifier who has coached triathletes with TriDot since 2014. Happy podcasting day to you, Elizabeth.
Well, happy podcasting day to you.
I'm Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people, and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we'll roll through our warm-up question, settle in for our main set conversation, and then wind things down with our cool down. Triathletes and cyclists love talking about their bikes, and I, of course, am no exception. I am so impressed by the quality of my Diamond Marquee TT bike. Every detail has been carefully engineered and crafted by the team at Diamond Bikes. My Marquee, complete with a custom TriDot paint scheme, sits proudly on the set of the TriDot Triathlon YouTube show for our audience to see. Their bikes are industry-leading aerodynamic machines, and they look awesome. But even beyond that, Diamond as a brand knows how to take care of their athletes. And with five different tri-bike models, as well as road, gravel, and mountain bikes, your next bike should absolutely be a Diamond. TriDot and Diamond are a dynamic race day 1-2 punch. Diamond provides you with the Ferrari of bikes, and TriDot training develops your engine. So we are excited to partner with Diamond on some really cool offers. If you are a new to TriDot athlete, we're offering 6 months of the Mark Allen edition of TriDot with the purchase of a Diamond bike. If you are already a TriDot athlete, we are offering a TriDot store credit with your new bike. Head to diamondbikes.com for all of the info and to dream up your very own Diamond bike.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
With the popularization of rolling starts in triathlon, it is becoming rarer and rarer to do a race where you start at the same time as the other competitors and thus get to feel like you are racing everybody as you pass and get past. However, even with a rolling start, you can enter the water right at the same time as another athlete to try to race them. So for our warm-up question today, I want to hear who in your life would you most want to throw down with? What rival would you most want to crush if you could start your races together? Anyone in the world, any name is fair game here. Who would you most want to directly race in a triathlon? Elizabeth James.
So for me, this was an easy answer. His name is Mark Wooten. And this isn't so much a rivalry, but he's actually one of the best training partners that I have ever had. He's paced me to my best races, including my sub-3 marathon. I've had the honor to be part of his crew for Leadville, Badwater, and some other really epic adventures. And he has mentioned more than once that, you know, he really wants us to outright race each other instead of kind of being the encouragement and
pacing. Yeah, so he's instigating this challenge. Yeah.
So he has already thrown this challenge down. And next April, we are going head-to-head at the Eugene Marathon. I was just trying to recruit Reigns into that before we were, you know, hitting record here. So maybe Reigns, you can come pace me. So I've still got my pacer as I throw down with Mark. Mark, he's retired from triathlon now. He's really conquering the ultra marathon world. But I would love to convince him back out of retirement just for one more race. Head-to-head competition in a triathlon.
Jeff Reigns, what is this answer for you? Who would you most want to race in a triathlon?
Oh, man. This is also a healthy competition. And Tri-Dot coach Brady Hoover doesn't know this this answer yet. But I used to coach him 4 or 5 years ago, pre-COVID, and he's a great runner. And him and I just became buddies, best friends, kind of remote training partners, so to speak. And we kind of were both having a marathon season where I had an A-race marathon coming up a few weeks after his A-race marathon that I was coaching him for. And, you know, we had similar projected finish times. And so we had a healthy competition. And he ended up beating me. He went 2:48 in his respective marathon, and I went 2:50 in mine. And that was 4 or 5 years ago. I want a rematch, buddy. I want a rematch. We've actually never gone head-to-head in the same race before. So maybe we pick another marathon in the spring to do winter, but maybe we pick a 70.3 and we both go head to head because we've never gone head to head in a triathlon either. So Brady, fastest marathon time this winter, and let's do Oregon 70.3, July 2024. Let's go head to head, buddy. Bring it on.
This answer for me is Tri-Dot coach and podcast regular John Mayfield. He has beaten me on 3 separate occasions by 1 second. And there's a backstory to all of them to where that's the reason. At Clash Daytona, we got in the water, I thought, at the same time, and we finished that race at the same time. And I guess I got in the water a second before him because, lo and behold, he beat me by 1 second, whereas I could have dropped the hammer and dropped him, but that's another story. Escape from Alcatraz, same thing. I hopped into the San Francisco Bay right before John Mayfield. You can literally see it on the camera feed. There goes Andrew, there goes John. And we finished that race together. And so he beat me by 1 second since I got in the water before him. And then
did y'all hold hands across the finish line, Andrew?
We did not, actually. That would have been cute. That would have been totally cute. We should have. Missed opportunity. I think I had my hands in the air. He kind of gave some Texas finger guns. I've got a picture of it on my computer that I bought from that race. And then the Pearland Half Marathon. I went down to Houston, Texas, and I paced John at the Pearland Half Marathon, trying to get him a PR at that distance. So I am slumming it at a slow pace for me to pace him to a PR. And same thing, I guess I crossed the start line just before he did. We finished at the same time, and he beat me by a second. So 3 different occasions, I've been beaten by this man by 1 second. I want redemption. I want to throw down with John on a triathlon, drop the hammer, and officially walk away with a faster time than him. So I'm calling John out. We're gonna have to get that on the schedule and make that happen. Hey, I want to hear from you, our Tri-Dot audience, on this question. Of everybody you know, who would you most want to race at a triathlon? Would it be a friend? Would it be a training buddy? Would it be your coach? Would it be a pro triathlete? Would it be someone else, randomly? If you could race anybody on a triathlon, who are you calling out? Who do you want to throw down with?
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
Before we get too deep into the show today, I want to give a shout out to our good friends at UCAN. Here at Tri-Dot, we are huge believers in using UCAN to fuel our training and racing. In the crowded field of nutrition companies, what separates UCAN from the pack is the science behind Live Steady, the key ingredient in UCAN products. While most energy powders are filled with sugar or stimulants that cause a spike and crash, UCAN energy powders, powered by Live Steady, deliver a steady release of complex carbs to give you stable blood sugar and provide long-lasting energy. I personally fuel my workouts with the orange-flavored Edge Gel and the unflavored UCAN Energy Powder. Between their energy mix, energy bars, almond butter, and more, there is definitely a Live Steady product that you will love. So head to their website, UCAN.co, and use the code TRIDOT to save 20% on your entire order. Now that code used to be 10%, but the fine folks at UCAN have upped it to 20% for Tri-Dot Nation, So once again, that's ucan.co, promo code TRIDOT. All right, very excited to solve some run problems today. I had a little list of my own of things that I thought people struggled with when it comes to the run. But just for good measure, I threw out to the I Am TRIDOT Facebook group this question, just saying, hey, when it comes to running, technique, workouts, race day, whatever, what are your biggest run problems? And people gave a lot of great feedback, a lot of great responses to that post. And from that, I curated the list of 10 talking points we'll be working through today, where we have Coach Jeff and Coach Elizabeth helping me solve your 10 biggest run problems. Okay, so let's get straight into it. Big run problem number one is motivation. Some athletes reported being bored during their runs. Others struggled to get out the door in the first place to get their run going. Coaches, how do you amp your athletes up for their runs? Elizabeth, what do you think?
What is going to get you out the door? Is it running with music? Is it running with others? If we can find something that makes it more enjoyable, then that's great. But I think the reality of this is, and this, you know, might sound a little harsh, but you are going to lack motivation at times. Like sometimes you just got to get out there and do it. I'll often encourage athletes to just get out there and get at least 10 minutes in. Most of the time, getting started is the hardest part. So once you're out there, you've done those first 10 minutes, normally you're like, yeah, okay, like it was a struggle to get started, but I can do more. And they usually end up doing like at least 75 to 100% of the prescribed session. So give yourself the opportunity to get it done. And then I'll say this too, for the athletes that don't like running, that are like, oh, I just really don't want to do this. It's often the things that we don't like that we need to be doing the most. So acknowledging that you don't want to do it and then doing it anyway can be a huge mental win and something that you can really draw back upon on race day and say, you know what, this was hard for me, but I really committed myself. I put in the time and I know that I'm going to reap the rewards of that.
Yeah, it's really interesting because just two episodes ago when we were having this same conversation about swimming, I mean, this was a main talking point, was people saying, man, I just getting in the car, getting into the pool is such a struggle. And I resonated with that. And I need to be going to the pool more often because of that, right? Like, and for me, getting out the door for a run is easy because I enjoy the run. But that's not, you know, it's different for everybody, right? So very, very good points there, Elizabeth. Jeff, anything to add here about things that you do with your athletes to help motivate them to go out there and get their run sessions in?
Yeah, you know, the run tends to be, you know, the hardest or maybe least favorite discipline for many triathletes. But at the same time, it's the easiest of the three to do, right? Just put on some run shoes, go out the front door, right? It takes me an hour sometimes just to get set up and everything for a bike ride. So running is the easiest of the disciplines to do, but it's the least favorite or hardest for some. So I get it. I like to have little games, so to speak, inside the workout or workouts within the workout. Yeah, you have your workout. You have your 4x8 minutes, you know, let's say inside of it. But, you know, I'll even, let's just say, like if I'm on the treadmill or elliptical, I'll play little like calorie burn, you know, per minute, you know, goals, or I have to have this cadence, or, you know, I have these little kind of games that I play to keep me intentional, kind of keep me on pace. Just things like that. So you can get creative with some of those. But I like to do that, like those really long, hard sessions or those long runs. Maybe you're going to do it on a treadmill or just whatever it is. But just be a little bit intentional. And that's different for everyone, right? I may say, hey, on your long run, I'd like to see an average cadence versus stride length of this, and let's do these things inside. And hey, after that run, we're going to talk about it, right? And is the data going to show? And so just that accountability aspect and having that kind of workout within the workout can help keep that motivation sometimes.
Yep, great stuff from both of you on that one. Big run problem number two is suddenly having to go number two. Running definitely jostles our innards more than the other sports do and can definitely induce the need to potty mid-session. How can we best prevent a GI issue from throwing off a good workout? Jeff Rains.
Andrew, I see what you did there. You made going number two problem number two.
Every now and then I'm really clever. Every now and then
Man,
I am somewhat
I love
clever.
This.
Yeah, it's Yeah, potty jokes are, yeah, they're good ones.
You know, I'm going to refer to this as the runner's trots. You know, that's kind of arguably, let's say, on social media, let's say, what the runner's GI or the runner's diarrhea, actually, for lack of a better word, is referred to. So the runner's trots, it is definitely a big issue. It is one that needs to be addressed. As much as you want to blush or giggle here, it is a big deal. And we have a whole podcast on this one. It's podcast episode 133, and it's the ABCs of number ones and number twos. And so you can refer to that one for a little bit more in depth. But I think the biggest thing, and Dr. Krista Austin, a podcast regular, has referred to eating a little bit less protein and less fiber leading into those big long runs, those hard sessions the day before and even race morning. You want to stay clear of too much of those because they can trigger some of the runner's trots. A lot of it can be, like, I call it the ground and pound, the tolerance of the ground and pound. So just being out there longer, the ground and pound, like you said, sloshing around. And so we want to do a healthy amount of cross training, but we also want to build up the volume duration and also the tolerance of that ground and pound aspect on harder surfaces, right? But, you know, like, some, you know, that have adjusted their diet and still just can't seem to keep normal balancing during those longer sessions have even taken things, you know, like Imodium or things that can help reduce or eliminate that runner's trots or those symptoms. And that can allow you to, you know, to focus on your running and racing and continue to consume carbohydrates throughout the race, but give maybe a lower risk of those GI issues. But taking supplementation is not always recommended. It, you know, it can be, or I would argue or encourage that it be more of a last result. You don't want to just always pop a pill or something before a long or before a race and rely on that. Let's try to cure it at the root of the problem. But, you know, a last resort, I would recommend taking Imodium or like a Pepto-Bismol, you know, dissolvable single serve tab, maybe like an hour before the session. I wouldn't take it during. It's actually recommended not to, but you shouldn't rely on those supplementations, especially also during like a high stress situation or a high sweat exercise, because they can alter the water electrolyte balancing throughout your bowels. But anyways, it's recommended that you could take a single dose, nothing crazy, an hour before. You don't want to do it every single day, you know, a regular daily fix, but a random, you know, every few weeks, if you want to pop that or try that, if you've tried everything and race day's just coming up and you need that. But anyways, I'll just say those Pepto-Bismol dissolvable chewables were a lifesaver for me. But it helped more nausea. So another piece of kind of runner's trots is nausea, not just the whole diarrhea and loose stool. So nausea is a big one. A little bit of carbonation can help mid race, or popping that little Pepto-Bismol tab can just help settle the stomach, because when you have that nausea, you just don't want to eat. But, you know, it usually happens later in a race or later in a long course, let's say marathon. And, you know, it's hard to rally back. And it just, by that portion of the race, you need to eat even more, right? You're at a deficit, most likely even more. And so you've got to continue to stay on your nutrition plan, but you have nausea and you don't want to eat, right? And so those Pepto-Bismol chewable tabs just saved me. And, you know, I refer to those as kind of that plan B or last resort, or have them in your race belt just in case.
Elizabeth James, what do you have to add here on potty prevention?
So one of the last things that Rain said is, you know, instead of just waking up and running out the door, literally and figuratively, as soon as you wake up to get that session in, that's a big part of what I usually end up talking with my athletes about, that are having these GI issues or feeling like they get started on a run and then it's interrupted by a bathroom break. And this really seems to happen most often with athletes trying to get that early morning run session in. And it doesn't matter necessarily if it's just the easy run, if it's the long run, but waking up, literally running out the door a couple minutes later seems to be a trend with where we see these issues come up.
Yeah, true.
And it really can be remedied in that case by giving yourself a little bit more time between waking up and beginning that session. I feel like for a lot of the athletes that I've worked with, if they have a very consistent morning routine where they give themselves a little bit more time in the morning, they're waking up, they're having breakfast, they're having their cup of coffee, they're doing some activation or warm-up exercises at the house before they even go and get started on the session outdoors, that really allows just that regularity of not only the routine of everything in the morning, but that bathroom routine as well. The other thing that I'll kind of pinpoint here is that, you know, a lot of athletes may want to journal about their food intake and see, you know, why they might be having an issue on some of these run sessions, but maybe not others. I mean, if you're going for your morning run and you ate chili the night before, well, you know, that might be an issue. But if you're having like chicken and mashed potatoes, maybe not so much. So you can really kind of journal and look at, you know, what are the foods that are best supporting my training? Do I have a slight food intolerance to some of these things? Do I need to adjust my fiber intake throughout the day? We do a lot of these things going into a race to make sure that we're prepared to not have that GI distress and those bathroom issues on race morning. But what do you need to alter in your week by week nutrition that's also going to support your training? I think that race week nutrition gets a lot of hype, a lot of attention, but our nutrition day to day sometimes really goes on the back burner, where if we are a little bit more intentional about that, it can support these training sessions without that same distress.
Yeah, and I'd add one last thing, just being consistent, doing those long sessions kind of the same time, if possible, like each day or each week, right? If one day you work out at noon and then you work out at 10 p.m., then you work out at 4 a.m. and you just jostle all that around, it can kind of throw things off. So, and then as you get closer to race day, try to, you know, the time of day at the start of the race, maybe you start trying to start that workout or those last few long sessions the same time of day that the race starts, and then you can start practicing those pre-race meals and 2 to 3 hours out and those types of things.
Big run problem number three is nailing the intervals in your workout. Unless it is a zone two run, I mean, you're going to have a few spicy intervals in your workout, sometimes zone four, zone five, up to zone six. Athletes discussed fading on their final interval, just not being able to hold the intensity they're supposed to all the way through to the end, or just not having the grit to dig deep and to do the pace they are prescribed. Coaches, how can we push the pace when the workout calls for it? Elizabeth.
One of the first things to remember is that for these trot out run sessions, the intervals are prescribed based on your recent assessment results. So they are attainable. Like, you can do this. Often these intervals look super intimidating, and that's when that self-doubt and the negotiation starts. Even before you go out for that workout. So just know that, like, this is based off of what you have already established is attainable for you. And so don't let that self-doubt creep in. I mean, really going in with the attitude of like, I am going to give this my best effort. And then looking at the pacing of the intervals, did you start too fast? I mean, athletes will often fade in the last couple intervals because they started off too fast at the beginning of the session. So, you know, just because you can go faster on those cruise intervals doesn't mean you should. You should be sticking to the prescribed paces so that you have great pacing throughout the session and aren't just like nailing the first three and then falling apart at the end. You know, those paces are prescribed for a reason. And then if you are sticking to those paces and you miss the last interval by like a few seconds, then okay, like that is still a really good session.
Yeah, true.
The intervals should be challenging. I mean, you should have to dig a little bit deep at the end. And that's something that you can improve upon next time. You know, let's say that you kind of started falling apart at the end of the last interval. That's still a fantastic workout. The training benefit of that is wonderful. Okay, so you didn't get the unicorn, you know, maybe didn't get the fantastic shout out in that 100%, but, you know, from a training perspective, you still made really good progress, and that's something that you can improve upon next time. And then last thing that I'll say here, I love doing my speed work with others. Even if we aren't doing the same workout, just being at the track with somebody else, Charles and I will go to the track together often, and more often than not, we do not have the same workout, but just being there at the same time holds me accountable to the workout structure. 'Cause I also know that like on the cool down jog, we're going to be talking about, like, hey, how'd your intervals go? And you don't want to be the one that's like, oh,
I bailed.
You
know, I fluffed it.
Exactly. Or I paced it terribly and I completely fell apart. You want to be like, yeah, I nailed it. Like, I had a great session. So, you know, involving others when you can, even if it's not the same workout, can really just give you that extra motivation, that extra push.
I love just the talk of, like, negotiating with yourself. I always think back to something John Mayfield has said on the podcast several times, and that's Tridot is designed for that last interval is where the biggest gains, the biggest fitness gains are. And if you bail on that last interval and the rest you have leading into that interval is designed to be a certain amount of time for a certain reason. And so the closer, and to your point, Elizabeth, you might not nail it, but the closer you can come to giving it your all the way through the end of all of those intervals, that's where the biggest fitness gains are. I always remind myself that when I'm doing those negotiations. Jeff Rains, anything to add?
Get to a track when you can. It's easy just to run out the front door. We all kind of have our long run routes or trails, but it's a little bit harder to kind of plan and work around football games and things like that at that local track. But if you can make it work, that'll really help. I will say, you know, that like you said, the last few minutes of a hard set are exponentially harder than the first few minutes. And wow. The old school way of training, the old training stress score model doesn't take that into account. It doesn't take age, gender, environment, all these things. So we know that our Tridot and Rundot normalized training stress is a much more new age accurate hardcore metric, so to speak. But there's a reason why you have been prescribed 4x5 minutes, and then the next week 4x8 minutes, or whatever that is for you. It's different for everybody. And then, like you said, some people have 1 minute rest, some people have 2-3 minute rest in between those sets. So there's a reason why, and that NTS prescribed that for a reason. And so, like you said, those last few minutes or that even last set are exponentially harder, but they're also more important. But a little trick is, like, if you're just, you know, obviously you don't want to just bury yourself and, you know, keep the integrity of the workout, right? You know, I know you want to get that 100 train X going, you want to get that last set in, but just know if you're doing it safely or not, or you're burying yourself or you're ruining tomorrow's workout. But a trick that you can do is know the range of that quality set. So know your high and low end of that zone 4 and zone 5 range. So you might want to do the first set or the first few minutes of a set at a low zone 4 just to get a feel for things. You're still doing threshold work. You're still getting a 100 train X score. Don't just go out at the super high end of zone 4 and then by sets 4, 5, and 6, you just have no gas left in the tank. So there's little things that you can do. You can manipulate where you're at inside of that range to be safe and consistent and things like that.
Big run problem number 4 is elevation gain and loss. These are the hills, people. This is running the hills. A couple components on this for you both to chew on that our athletes brought up. How to train for hills when you live somewhere flat. What was a common one, especially for our Floridians and our Texans. Prepping for hills when your training doesn't prompt you to do hill repeats. I've seen hill repeats a few times in Tridot, not a ton. But how can you train hills if you're not doing hill repeats? And then how to pace hills properly in your workouts. You're supposed to hold certain zones, certain paces, and you go up and down hills. It makes it hard to hold those paces. Jeff, start shooting on all those points for us.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, the big thing now is gap, grade adjusted pace. So
hills, baby, hills.
So it takes the pace you're running on that hill, but it says, hey, this hill is 5% grade hill. So internally, your body may think you're running a lot faster than what the actual GPS pace says. So gap is something that you can use if you have to do a set on a hilly course. But then if you have a hilly race coming up, you want to get on to hills, because we've said it before that the human body doesn't really know a hill. It just knows that effort. But at the same time, you still have to know and get out on hills and practice the technical aspects of running up a hill, right? You're going to pick your knees up higher. Is your body lean going to be a little bit different? Things like that. Your arm carriage might be a little different. So we need to get on hills. But there are times where, I'd like to do them on that track, on that flat, really nail the pacing, get that internal physiological, adaptation. But then as I get closer to a hilly race day, I'll incorporate some of those sets on the hills. But the biggest thing I think that we should all be doing is the weekly strength training. And I know you're like rolling your eyes. Like, I know I need to do my run drills. I know I need to do my strength training, yoga, recovery, all those things that help your performance on a hill. But there's something really cool I want to mention real quick, and a shout out to Tri-Dot athlete and Run-Dot athlete Jeff Krebs. He just had a bunch of testing done in the lab with Doctors of Running coach and Dr. Matt Klein.
Yeah.
They've been on our podcast before, and they have a great lab. So they did a bunch of exercise testing recently with Jeff Krebs in their lab, doing all sorts of testing on different carbon-plated shoes and all these things, and just stride length versus cadence and performance and all these awesome metrics. And what they deemed in his test is that a lot of athletes put on these shoes and they're not used to it. And there's kind of a wobble or an unstable aspect to landing on that softer, less dense type of foam. And so that wobble effect is kind of like a hill, or that stabilization effect. And so when you're doing your strength training, right? Don't just, you know, we know you need to get out of the sagittal plane and all of those things that Dr. BJ Leeper has said, but you can do it on a slightly unstable but safe surface. So instead of just doing single leg deadlifts, which that is arguably one of the most important and best strength exercises that you can do as a runner, single leg deadlifts, but maybe you want to do those standing on a little foam squishy pad, right? So you got to stabilize while you're doing the single leg deadlift. And so doing that will help that kind of stabilization or that wobble effect, or if your shoe is you know, an uneven surface type of a thing, and you'll have better performance and longevity in the race. So that's something you can do, is incorporate that into your strength training.
Yeah, no, love it. And definitely people don't think through the implications for stability of your run form, and those stability muscles can add a whole lot to your experience if you beef those up a little bit with some of those deadlifts like Jeff's talking about. Elizabeth, what do you have to add here on kind of these elevation gain and loss questions our athletes are asking?
I think just a couple additional recommendations for somebody that's training for hills that lives in like a flatter area. I mean, I know that the treadmill is a dreaded tool for some. But
I've embraced it in my mid 30s. I've finally started embracing the treadmill. It's a little easier on my body.
It's really not that bad. And it can be a fantastic tool. And especially if you're looking for, you know, the opportunity to do some incline work if you're living in a flat area. You know, I always say try to find some bridges, try to find some overpasses if you're living in a more urban area that maybe is a little more flat, lots of sidewalks instead of, you know, some nice rolling hills that you can find. But the treadmill is a great option too. And one of the things that I really like about using the treadmill is that if you understand the terrain of your upcoming race and you're racing a hilly course, you can look into RaceX and look at, okay, you know, what is the elevation profile of this race? And one of the things that I've done is kind of recreate some of those like hills per se on the treadmill when I'm doing a long run that is forced indoors because of weather. And so if I'm not able to, you know, do a run outside, not only does this make the time on the treadmill go faster, but I feel like I'm really getting some good visualization of where the hills are in my upcoming race course, getting some really good practice of just the, you know, technique of where I'm running the hills, seeing how that influences my heart rate, kind of understanding what the great adjusted pace or that gap that Jeff Rains was just talking about is going to be as I'm climbing up some of those more steep inclines. I mean, some of the treadmills now have a nice decline feature that you can use to not only go up, but down those elevation gains as well. And then, you know, in addition to gap, one of the other things that I've been using and a number of my coached athletes have been using as well is running with power.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're not just looking at a specific pace, we're looking at what that power is and how much we need to get up a steep incline. And so you're not, you know, blowing yourself up in a workout, and using power can be a great way to pace the hills in your workouts and then ultimately during race day as well.
Yeah, running with gap is more accurate than just running by pure pace when you're going up and down hill. And then running with power is even better than gap. Just from my personal experience, we have rolling hills where I live, nothing mountainous, but certainly not flat. And when I would pace my runs by gap, you know, the gap number on my Garmin watch was always a little bit delayed from what I was actually doing. Whereas that power number, it's an instantaneous feedback on exactly how hard you're pushing right then and there in the moment. Definitely makes a huge difference in accurately holding those zones whilst running up and downhill. So good call there, EJ. Big run problem number five is fueling and hydrating your runs. I mean, it gets a little bit easier on the bike where you can actually put some bottles on your bike. You can put some fuel in your pockets. But when you're out and about going for a run outdoors, it can be a little bit harder to do. So guys, how can we remedy this on our runs? How can we carry fluids, carry the calories we need, and get all of that in? EJ, what do you think?
I think there's a couple different things here. First, as you mentioned, it's very cumbersome to carry everything for a run session. So I will often do a session where I can leave my nutrition, hydration in a specific location, whether that's, you know, in the edge of the driveway and I'm doing loops kind of by the house, or, you know, the Sunday track sessions and I can just leave it at a corner of the track and I can, you know, do my warm up, come back, grab some hydration. If it's a longer session, you know, maybe have a gel there where I can grab that partway through as well. And then here's something, you can also stop. I think there's just this runner's mentality where they have to run for the entire session and, you know, walking or stopping, it's not allowed. I think we're getting better about that.
Everybody saw Forrest Gump, Elizabeth. Everybody saw Forrest Gump and they want to keep running.
And they're like, have to keep going. You have to keep going. I think we're getting better about this with understanding, you know, like zone two runs and heart rate and, you know, slowing down, walking sometimes if needed. But think of it this way. Okay, like cyclists often stop at gas stations along their routes to refuel. I mean, I've done so many long Saturday rides where I physically can't carry all of that with me. So I'll stop at a gas station, buy some more hydration, buy a little bit of snack. You know, that's allowed. Like nobody questions that. You refuel and then you move on. But we don't have that same mentality as a runner. I mean, you can go stop at a gas station, get yourself, you know, a bar, get yourself some water and then keep going. That's okay too. I think another piece here though, is that people often think that their run workouts aren't long enough to warrant taking in sports nutrition. I mean, you know, on the bike, we're out there for 6 hours, so it's, you know, acceptable. But you know, those run sessions can be opportunities for fueling as well. And fueling during a session can lead to better performance, even if it's not a 2 hour long
better performance session. Better recovery on the back end,
exactly.
Having your body, yes, be ready for tomorrow's session that much more because you fueled that run. Yeah, mm-hmm. All the above.
Yep. Yeah. And so just I think this idea of taking in fuel for a run like also needs to be a little bit more accepted, just universally. And when we're doing that, allowing ourselves to stop, knowing that, you know, this is important, it's critical for our training, hopefully that will help too.
I love running at the track anyway, so it's easy to just kind of leave things in the corner of the track, like you said, and stop every couple laps for it. I very often on those long runs, when the runs get 90 minutes, 2 hours, whatever, you know, I'll do little out and backs from my house, right? And I'll go out 45 minutes back, you know, are out 30, back 30, you know, refill, refuel, grab fresh gels, and then go out another 30 and back 30. And so, yeah, doing out and backs, doing loops to kind of stop at your house. Yeah, all great stuff there, EJ. Jeff Rains, anything to add on fueling and hydrating, or have we properly covered it?
You guys nailed it. I mean, I'll just say, don't be afraid to walk. I'm becoming a more and more advocate of the run walk, and I've been chatting with Jeff and Weston Galloway, and just some really cool insight. You can still be fast and do those run walk protocols if you need to, or you know, and then you can always incorporate more of those as you're early into that race prep stamina phase, volume phase, but then as you get closer to race day, try to take fewer and fewer of those walk breaks if there's a real, you know, big time goal in that A race, right? And just 30 seconds of walking, you almost cover, or speed walking, I should say, you almost cover the same amount of ground as if you were running. But those just, you know, call it random, or if you want to have an exact protocol, right, 4.5 minutes run, 30 seconds walk, whether you do that continuously for your whole 2 hour run, or you know, you just do some random 30 second ones throughout, regardless, 30 seconds is enough time to bring your heart rate down, and it really, really can be beneficial. Don't be afraid to take those just random little breaks to refuel, reset, refocus, and get back in it.
Big run problem number six is improving our run form. And this should be and will be its very own podcast. So we'll keep this light and breezy on this episode today. Talking to you, Jeff Rains, keeping this light and breezy here. We'll go deeper another day. So what we want to cover here, you know, people's main questions on this topic that I saw in the group were, how to identify when something is off with our run form, how to decrease vertical oscillation, as in how much that we are bouncing in our run stride, how to optimize our stride length, how to increase our run cadence. I think people hear about all of those metrics and they know they need to do certain things, but they don't know how to achieve those changes in their run form. So Jeff Rains, jump in first. Maybe they'll start with vertical oscillation.
Oh man, only 90 seconds. Holy cow. That is a challenge, my man. Okay. Vertical oscillation and stride length. Let's jump in. I mean, just to throw out some numbers, 5 to 10 centimeters is a healthy vertical oscillation. That's about 2 to 4 inches. The goal should be less vertical oscillation. So maybe closer to 2 to 2.5 inches being the goal, but 2 to 4 inches being okay, 5 to 10 centimeters. I'll say this though, really taking a step back. The first thing to look for and pinpoint are, deviations in your form. Right now, you don't have to get a run analysis or something, or go see a podiatrist only when you're injured, or a PT, physical therapist. Like, you could do it now when you're injury free, because finding and looking and addressing those deviations will improve your running economy and your running efficiency, regardless of if you're injured or not. You could be 100% injury-free, but you have some deviations. You have some things going on, a mild hip drop or a leg crossing the midline or a leg kicking out wide. Little things like that could lead to an injury someday or eventually, so we want to address them now. But also, if addressing them, you could improve your economy, and that's free speed, right? Leveling out that hip drop, right, might give you 10 seconds per mile because you're traveling 0.1 meters longer now on that leg, you know, that was that side that was dropped, right? Things like that. But too much vertical oscillation, it can be an inefficiency, and that is that extra upward momentum. There's two main ways to increase your speed in running. You can keep your cadence about the same. I like to stay in about a 5 to 8 step per minute window. But you can keep your cadence the same and manipulate stride length, right? So if the cadence is the same and you want to speed up, you got to increase your stride length. You got to travel further per step. Or the inverse, right? You could keep your stride length the same, but you're going to have to increase your cadence to speed up, right? So there's a game that you got to play, and it's different for everybody. There's no magic number. Most people, I think, would argue, at least for longevity, endurance, shorter stride, higher cadence is key. Keeping the cadence about the same is a good goal, and manipulating stride length a little bit more to dictate speed is a little bit more recommended, so to speak. But again, there's always the it depends. I'll end with this. Your Garmin's will report average meters per stride, right? Most are kind of a 0.8 meters or 1.1-ish meters is probably a normal range that I see in most. So you go do an hour long run, not an outlier, right? Not a weird hills or anything like that. It's a decent run, good data. And you come home and you look at average pace and all that. But I scroll down and I say, okay, average stride length was this compared to my cadence. If it's an easy zone 2 day, you know, what was my stride length versus cadence? Was it an interval day? What was my stride length versus cadence? Long run day, stride length versus cadence. And you can start to piece together a beautiful picture or do some detective work and kind of see, okay, this is how, my numbers look a little bit more unique when I do this type of workout and things like that. And so you can start to be intentional and diagnose yourself, so to speak. But mainly in developmental phase, earlier in the season, and for my more experienced runners, is where I'll start to manipulate stride length versus cadence. And you can adjust those year to year, season to season, and get more and more aggressive, so to speak, and be, you know, a faster, better runner, in the long run, so to speak, or season to season. But that hopefully, I don't know, it was over 90 minutes, but it's a lot of info
90
there.
Minutes.
And hopefully that made a little bit of sense. 90 seconds, excuse me.
it was over 90 seconds, Jeff, and it was all really, really good information. And you are a scientist on this, which we always appreciate. And scientists know a lot of things and want to communicate those things that they know. So I always appreciate that in you. But so I want to make sure that the takeaway is clear for somebody who knows, okay, maybe I have too much vertical oscillation, or I have too short or too long of a stride length. What is the fix for somebody that can see those deviations in their metrics? Is it working on the cadence and working on the stride length and seeing what decreases that oscillation, or what's the fix here if you know you have a problem?
Yeah, you know, it's better to run, you know, a shorter or less distance with good form rather than just tacking on, you know, a bunch of mileage with bad form, because it reinforces bad habits. And really focusing on your form is key. Maybe taking those walk breaks, like we mentioned, kind of helps wake things up. But a quicker turnover, plyometric speed, not skipping your run, drills, and your strength session.
Yeah,
do
point.
Your warm-up, do the drills. It's not the easiest thing to do in the dark in your driveway, you know, a bunch of high knees, butt kicks, A skips, things like that. But you got to do something. You got to do it. I'll say late in a marathon, you know, mile 17 or so, your form breaks down. Your hip flexors are the first things to go, and you lose the knee drive. Well, when you lose the knee drive, you lose the distance per stride. You start to subconsciously kick out the lower leg and overly heel strike and try to grab subconsciously more distance to compensate and stay on pace. But the runner that can keep the knee drive, the distance per stride, the longest into that session is the more successful one. And the only way to do that is muscular endurance. And the only way to build that strength and endurance is to do your strength session.
EJ, talk to us about cadence. For people who know that there's a couple of posts where people very specifically saying, I know my cadence is a little slow. I need to speed it up. How do I do that? Talk to us about what our cadence should be and how to make sure that it is in the right zone.
I think cadence, along with a lot of the other metrics that Rains was just talking about, the first thing here is to kind of like know where you are. And you can figure that out by either, you know, looking at your running device such as Garmin or Stride, or you can even, you know, manually count how many steps per minute you're taking. But knowing like, okay, where am I at right now? And then asking yourself the question, does this need to change? And there's an acceptable range for running cadences. And, you know, Jeff already kind of talked about, you know, how cadence and stride length are, you know, interconnected. And there's a lot of pieces to cadence other than just like how quickly your foot is hitting the ground, how many times per minute it's hitting the ground. And because there's this acceptable range for running cadence, just because you fall like a little bit above or below what might be considered ideal doesn't automatically warrant like an immediate overhaul in your running mechanics. You know, if your cadence is 140 steps per minute, then yeah, okay, we're going to want to pick that up. But, you know, if it's something like 175 and you're like, oh man, like ideal is 180, not necessarily. Like, you know, you are within an acceptable range here. And so we want to go about this in a very smart and strategic way. If you are looking to improve your running and you kind of know where you are in terms of those metrics right now, cadence or otherwise, and you're thinking, okay, how do I improve this? Working with a coach, getting a run form analysis. I mean, those are some really key things that I think are well worth the investment, because you want to make sure that you aren't necessarily doing a complete overhaul of running mechanics for something that doesn't need to change, or you're not compromising good hip extension for a higher cadence and you're putting more flexion into your running mechanics and creating other issues. So every time I hear Brains talk about it, I'm like, man, like, you know, his athletes are so blessed with his knowledge in, I mean, all disciplines, but particularly the run. And for athletes that are looking to really make improvements there and know that there's room for improvement, working with a specialist is really going to be one of the greatest investments in that area.
Okay, so big run problem number 7 is getting the right run shoe or multiple shoes in a rotation. Athletes were asking questions about how many run shoes should I have, how do I know when it's time to replace them, and how do I find a pair my feet will be happy with? Jeff Rains, what do you think?
You know, I'd refer back to podcast episode number 3, actually, just to learn about running shoes in general.
Episode 3, back in 2019.
Throwback, yeah.
Still good, still applies, but, still good information.
Yeah, I mean, there's some new shoe models out there, but no, it still all applies. You know, I like to have that one just good go-to safe shoe that you do the majority of your training in. It is good to have 2 or 3 pairs, maybe a long run, a speed day, and then the one you're going to race in. I kind of have that kind of middle ground shoe. It's not like a racing flat or race day shoe, but it's not kind of my heavy-ish trainer. It's kind of that middle speed day shoe. But anyways, yeah, I mean, rotating pairs is also good inside of that. So if you've got 3 pair of running shoes for each type of run. You could even have another one of each of those that you kind of rotate in, especially as you know one is getting towards the end of its life. So you don't just want to throw out one shoe one day and then the next day buy a new shoe and go run a 15-mile run in it, right? So you want to cycle that new one in. But most shoes have a life expectancy. It'll say that on their website. Most these days are kind of around that 300 to 400 miles. Some advertise more, but really, honestly, 400 miles is like a max I like to put on one specific shoe. And then you're kind of lighter, sleeker, less material, more of a race day, especially the less dense, higher stack height carbon plated shoes. They're kind of more of a 250, mile life expectancy type of a shoe. But the big thing is know what category of shoe that you need. Are you a stability? Do you over pronate and you need some quote correction? Is there an inefficiency? Pronation is good. Too much can be bad. So there are shoes that try to help correct that a little bit. So what category are you in? And then once you know that category, go try each brand's version of that. And I like to say, if you are blindfolded and you tried on 5 shoes, as long as you know you're in that right category, pick that shoe that feels the best on your foot. Go with that one.
Yeah, Jeff, earlier in the episode, you referenced Doctors of Running, and I cannot recommend their website and their YouTube content, their Instagram content enough. They really study how shoes interact with runners' feet, and all the information they put out on their website, reviewing shoes, talking about shoes, is based in data and facts and studies. So definitely go consume their content if you have more questions on this. Big run problem number 8 is running off the bike. This is very unique to triathlon and duathlon. Everyone remembers the very first time they run off the bike on race day and question all of their life choices. It's very different. It's a very different feeling. It's not the same as just going for a run. How can athletes get better at settling into a groove off the bike? And how can they have a great run split even on legs that have already gone for a swim and a bike?
Okay, so I have to first say, like, questioning all of their life choices. I mean, that was very appropriate as part of that question.
How many times have you done that as a triathlete? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Times.
You get off the bike and you're like, why am I in this sport? Like, what kind of torture do I put myself through on a, weekly basis or, bi-weekly basis to do this? So, yeah, very appropriate as part of that question there. And here I would say practice. And practice running different paces off of the bike. So TriDot prescribes runs off the bike that are, all zone 2. And then we've got the ones that are zone 2 into zone 3, or, starting at zone 3, easing back into zone 2, ones that are at your goal race pace. And so practicing, but also practicing all of those different paces off the bike is going to be incredibly helpful. And yeah, it's going to feel weird. You're going to question your life choices, but understanding how your body responds to that transition and really how long it takes to kind of feel like you get your legs back under you is going to provide you with information and confidence that you can draw upon come race day. I mean, for me, I know that like my first mile off the bike, it doesn't feel the same. And I'm kind of in like one or two camps. Either I get off of the bike and I'm like, man, this feels good. I think it's just the adrenaline of like getting off the bike and I actually go too fast.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay,
so
like rein this in a little bit. Like we've got a ways to go here. Or I get off and I'm like, oh my gosh, like this is miserable. Like I don't know if I can do this. And then, like 5 minutes later, I'm in a good groove and I'm like, okay, yeah, this is fine. And so I think it's just the practice, the experience and understanding that like it will come around. But knowing that and having the confidence that you'll be able to find those legs again on race day is important.
Big run problem number 9 is staying healthy. We can't show off our hard work and training if we can't stay healthy enough to get onto the start line of a race. And running has quite the reputation for ruining knees, feet, calves, back, soles, and spirits. Coach Elizabeth, what do you have your athletes do to stay healthy?
First off, if you do too much or train faster than you should, that's when you're more likely to get injured. And TriDot takes care of this for you. So stick to your training plan. Stick to your prescribed paces. If you are doing the right training right, then you have incredibly lessened your likelihood for injury. And then, be mindful. Listen to your body when just something doesn't feel good. And it is much better to back off, to, take that session shorter than to push through on something that is painful and then really, you know, find yourself on the sidelines for multiple days or multiple weeks. And then, you know, not only just like with our, you know, feet, legs, calves, everything that you listed, but also our immune system. I mean, we need to stay healthy too with that in terms of training. And I think all of this comes with being diligent of the details that support your training. So eating well, sleeping well, prioritizing recovery, you know, replacing your running shoes as needed, all of those little details really play into preventing injury as well.
Big run problem number 10 is pushing past a performance plateau. Some athletes do the workouts, they've seen improvement in the past, but the runability just seems to have like kind of leveled off at a certain point. Is there a point where we're just as fast as we can get, or are there tricks to pushing through and getting even faster? This is our last question. I'd love to hear from both of you, so let's maybe start with Jeff and move to Elizabeth to shut down our main set today. Jeff Rains.
Yeah, there's definitely, you know, quote, tricks to getting past that plateau or getting always getting faster. And we're seeing with TriDot that, you know, people are older and older, but seeing more and more improvements, even the older that they get. But, you know, podcast episode 82, Pushing Past the Performance Plateau, really breaks down swimming, biking, and running. But what I would say as far as the plateau, you know, effect or not seeing as great of gains as athletes want, I get it a lot. Like, why? Hey, Jeff, you know, whatever. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, the first thing I ask is, when was the last time you did all 7 of your run drills before that run workout? And did you do that for all 3 or 4 of your runs this week? All right. So actually, it's like, have you done 30 plus run drills in the last 7 days? Right. And they're like, oh, no, you know, oh, hey, did you do your strength training? You know, hey, yoga, did you go get that massage or whatever? Right. And so those are the things I go to first. And usually, you know, when those things are neglected, you start to see less gains or a plateau, even whatever, you want to call that. But spending more and more months in precious developmental phase is key. Athletes who put too many A races, or they stay in that race prep volume stamina phase, I call it, too many months out of the year. So let's just say, you know, you're 9 months till your first half Ironman, right? 6-ish arguably of those, you know, should or could be that developmental phase. And the last couple months, you'll ramp up the stamina. That's the fast before far, the strong before long. And so doing that each season is key. Having too many A races and you only have 2 months of development and you do stamina, then you do a big race. Then you sign up for another A race and you only get 1 month of developmental before you hit stamina again for that race. And so staying in that precious developmental will help you get past that performance plateau. Don't skip your assessments. We have a whole podcast on that. Even if you don't think you're going to see that great gain, you still need to do it. There's so many benefits of doing those assessments I alluded to earlier. Fixing deviations and inefficiencies will help get past a performance plateau. You know, you've gained as much fitness or functional threshold that you could in the last 4 months or this season or whatever. But hey, can you get even faster on race day by fixing inefficiencies, leveling out a hip drop, and all those things we mentioned earlier? A lot of athletes don't train the zone 2 range enough or correctly. Hey, I got a 40-minute zone 2 run, and you know they may stay in zone 2 for the first 20 minutes, but then they want to go run fast, and their heart rate's in upper zone 3, low zone 4 for the second half. Well, you didn't achieve the goal of that session. Mobility, stability, yoga, skipping those, not doing them correctly, or just doing all your favorite lifts all the time and not doing those less fun ones, right? So do the ones that you don't like, because you don't like them probably because you neglect them the most. Sure. and you actually need them the most. Don't skip your warm-up, your cool-down, your foam rolling, cross-training. I'll end with that. Cross-training is huge for preventing injury, promoting recovery. You know, if you can't keep the integrity of a session, don't force the session, right? I do a lot of my Thursday Zone 2 hour bike rides as a cross-training session. I'll manually complete it. It's totally fine. Keep your heart rate in Zone 2. Right? Keep the integrity of the workout. But I'll do a lot of 15 minutes recumbent bike at the gym, 15 minutes elliptical, 15 minutes rowing, Stairmaster. And then I'll manually complete that session, right? It's fun. It changes things up. Doing that here and there, you know, can get you past that performance plateau of just doing something different, having fun, the morale, motivation. I know that was a long list, but I tried to roll through those quickly.
Yeah, and Jeff, it's probably a little different for everybody, right? It probably depends on why they've plateaued. And so you just kind of gave us a lot of little bullets in the gun to fire and see what actually kind of helps us through that breakthrough. Elizabeth, close out the main set today. What would you say to an athlete who is just plateauing in their runnability?
I mean, I've been there, and I'll admit, like, it's frustrating when you hit those plateaus. But I think having this growth mindset and understanding that there still is room for improvement, and that, like, your consistency and your diligence to many of the things that Rains just outlined are important and will allow you to break through that plateau. I mean, that's a really important attitude to keep. What usually gets asked as part of this, and I mean, we've touched on it a little bit, is, you know, okay, well, I'm 10 years older now. There's no way I can beat my times from when I was such and such years old. And, you know, maybe from a strict timing perspective, you can't, but there's always other ways to measure improvement too. And I think I'll just leave with this, you know, Olympic track athletes still train day in and day out for portions of a second faster in their race. And, you know, those improvements may be slow after the initial gains are made, but there still is improvement to be made.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
Hey, friends. It's cool down time, and I'm Vanessa, your average triathlete with elite level enthusiasm. Today on the cool down, we have Coach Ben, who is currently located near the historic Roman city of Bath, which I highly recommend y'all go and visit sometime because it is gorgeous. But back to Ben. He is a member of the Precision Coaching Team and has quite the triathlon resume. He is a former elite junior triathlete, has represented Great Britain as an age grouper at Worlds and European Championships. He has 8 national championship medals and is a 2-time national champion. Coach Ben accomplished all of this over 10 years and has since progressed to coaching as a way of giving back to the community with the goal of helping others improve their physical and mental health and well-being through triathlon. He specializes in intermediate to elite level triathletes who have an interest in sprint and Olympic distance races. Not only is he a rock star triathlete and coach, he rounds out his knowledge base working full-time for a sports collagen recovery nutrition supplement brand, where he supports people to optimize their recovery to drive better performance. Welcome to the show, Coach Ben.
It's awesome to be here.
Now, I love this little known fact about you, Ben. Before becoming a triathlete, you loved performing on stage in musical theater and Shakespeare productions. So my question to you is, what was your favorite role that you ever played?
Oh, that is an excellent question. And it's a really, really difficult question to answer because I have two favorite roles in two complete polar opposites. But I will pick out a single favorite. And my single favorite was a full unabridged production of A Midsummer Night's Dream by William Shakespeare with my school's theatre company. And I played the lead, not the lead role in terms of the human characters, but the lead fairy character of Puck, the young, mischievous sort of almost devilish but quite charming and quirky little fairy who kind of is seen and amongst the entire plot, and that was a role of a lifetime. I was quite young as well, so I had the energy and the enthusiasm.
Yeah, that sounds it sounds like a very wonderful role to play. And I'm wondering, was this a role that do you think fits your personality in real life?
It did, certainly at the time. As I said, I was a younger teenager back in my younger years, where I had the sort of the naivete and the freshness and the keenness of a young person. So for them, it was the perfect role. I've matured a little bit now. It wouldn't quite be the right role for me these days if I was to step back on stage, which I do not plan to. I'm far too busy.
Yeah, right. I understand that. That's what happens when you enter triathlon and you do 3 sports and you also coach and then you have a full-time job. There's very little time for anything extra. So what super awesome tip do you have to share with us today?
My super awesome tip, I'm hoping it's super awesome.
It will be.
For everybody listening today. It's all about nutrition and recovery. As a very injury-prone athlete, and I'm sure there's going to be loads of people listening today or whenever you're listening to this, who are considering themselves injury prone, are currently injured, or are just recovering from an injury. They've tried modifying their training. They've missed training. They've missed races. They've been to the physios. They've been doing their stretches, rehab exercise. I'd been there, done that. The one thing that really struck me was that I wasn't taking the time both when I was injured or not injured, to optimize the recovery process. And that was between training sessions. When I was on the go, I wasn't eating correctly. I wasn't fueling for the both demands of exercise and then recovery afterwards. And so again, it's very much the little things. It's about ensuring you've got a ample supply of high quality protein, carbohydrates, you're staying well hydrated to fuel the demands of the exercise, the activity you're doing both in sport and your life. And then not ignoring the fact that your life is still busy. You need to still keep eating, still keep hydrating when you're not exercising, because then that's going to help you prepare for the next session. But also it's going to reduce the chances of injury, because your body is, it's fueled, it's full of the right nutrients to both perform and then recover afterwards. Recovery is where your sessions really count, because you can do a really hard session if you don't adequately recover, and that can be nutrition and everything else, all the other modalities around it, which I'm sure a lot of other coaches will talk to you about in future episodes. If you don't optimize those little processes afterwards, the quality of that session just diminishes and diminishes and diminishes. And then over time, it leads to excess fatigue and then breakdown that your body just simply can't keep up with. And when you're doing three sports multiple times a day, week, month, year, it stacks up. And speaking from experience, it becomes a significant limiter and a significant demotivator for me, to the point where I almost quit the sport because I physically wasn't able to maintain the frequency nor the volume that I enjoyed doing.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like the story of a lot of people. I heard a statistic when I first started triathlon that most triathletes will start and end their career within 5 years. And I think that it's mostly because people do not prioritize that recovery process. Like they don't take the time to, you know, do the stretching, do the mobility. And in addition to that, just what you've said is to make sure that you're fueling appropriately, because it can sneak up on us if we're under fueling or if our nutrient, you know, macro and micronutrients aren't on point. It's definitely going to create that opportunity for the body to just break down.
Absolutely. And in the short term, the body will make do and it will carry on and it will do its best to do the best that it can to deal with what you're putting it through. But eventually it just goes, I can't do this anymore. This isn't sustainable. And if we're talking about consistency over a long period of time, we want to be physically active, not least to be able to compete in triathlon, but also just to be physically active so that we can maintain vitality, health, and longevity as we simply just get older. Our lives are busy. We squeeze exercise into the little time we already have. The last thing that we do is then account for the recovery process. So if we're going to make one change as we go into the off season and into next year's season, let's optimize that recovery process, everybody.
I love it. Can you share, I'm just dying to know, what your favorite post-workout recovery fuel looks like? Like what do you do? What do you put in your body as soon as you finished a training session?
I'm usually on the go after a training session. So I need something fast. I need something palatable. I need something convenient with all the right nutrients that I need post-exercise. So I'm very well hydrated already. So I will always have something for water with electrolytes throughout the day regardless. So I don't necessarily have to worry about that. But I will have a really high quality whey protein plus collagen shake. And I'll have a nice banana, maybe a muesli sort of granola bar afterwards, just to get both a high quality source of dietary protein, collagen protein, and carbohydrates and electrolytes. And then maybe an hour to 2 hours later, I'll have a substantial meal. I don't quite have the appetite immediately post an intense training session to have a large meal with all the proper whole foods that we should be having as a non-negotiable every single day, multiple times a day. I need something fast, something convenient. I can get on with my day. And then when I've settled, straight to a nice whole food meal to fuel me to the next training session, or just to fuel me for the rest of my day.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great Tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.